Well, welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. Glad to have you here today for our program titled Governing the Global Commons, International Environmental Law, led by Professor Kevin Doran from the University of Colorado. As usual, we'll plan a discussion with Gary Gray, refereeing after the presentation. Before we begin, Ken Daniels is going to offer a word of prayer.
We thank you, Father, for being with us this afternoon, for watching over us and providing for us each of our needs of our hearts. We thank you for bringing this message to us, the information that we will learn here and contemplate. We hope will enable us to serve thee better. In Jesus' name, amen.
I'd like to share with you just a few words written by Harry Meserve that seem apropos for today's discussion. I guess these were really part of a prayer originally. From making war and calling it peace, special privilege and calling it justice, indifference and calling it tolerance, pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves and others that evil is inevitable, while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. Just a sort of little news note on upcoming event. Next fall, the Adventist Forum National Association Spectrum Magazine is holding their national meeting in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's the weekend after Labor Day. And the topic is A Third Way Beyond the Conservative-Liberal Divide to a Christian Identity Refreshed by Interfaith Dialogue. And three of the speakers are Brian McLaren, who is a leading figure in the emerging church movement, Samir Silmanovic, who is an Andrews graduate, who founded Faith House Manhattan, an interfaith ministry in New York City. Some of you may have read his book, It's All About God. And then William Johnson, former editor of the Adventist Review. So I'm sure that will be a stimulating weekend, and if you're interested and available, you can start planning toward that. I apologize, and this is probably speaking to the wrong people. We had a major problem with the email notifications. This month, all of the Andrews addresses bounced back, but we eventually resent, and I think hopefully most of them got through. But if some of you have changed email addresses or would like to be on the list and are not getting notified, we do have sheets in the back that you can sign up. And we appreciate the work of Jim and Daryl and Terry and Debbie, who contribute to getting the information out and the programs recorded and the website going. Well, today's presentation, as said, is called Governing the Global Commons, International Environmental Law. And our discussion is led by Professor Kevin Doran. He's an attorney and a professor at the University of Colorado Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute. he's also managing director for the Carbon Management Center, which is a research collaboration between the U.S. government and three of the Colorado institutions of higher learning. In addition, he holds a faculty appointment at the Colorado Energy Research Institute, located at the Colorado School of Mines. And he has to live in the Boulder, Colorado area to do all this, which is a real sacrifice. His research focuses on legal, regulatory, and public policy dimensions of energy development. He's been involved in lots of things. And we could go on, but you'd want to hear him, not about him. I would mention, though, that he has written lots of scholarly articles and contributed to various books. Particularly relevant for today's presentation, he's co-author of one of the most widely used textbooks on international environmental law. It's called International Environmental Law in a Nutshell. So, we thank you for coming, Kevin. Kevin, and the time is yours, and interested in what you have to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. And in particular, I'd like to thank Professor Gary Gray and Meredith Gray for extending the invitation for me to come on out here. I was just reminiscing a little bit, and it turns out that this room is the room that I had my first Andrews University course in. I graduated from Andrews University in 1996, I believe, but when I was a freshman, this was my first course, and I had the unusual, I suppose, distinction of being a freshman at 16. And this was a sociology course, and kind of like today, where there are some children out there in the back making a little bit of noise, we had a group of students from Andrews Academy out there in the back. And I remember the professor sitting here, and I was right about there, and he said, well, at least we don't have those 16-year-olds in here. And I just kind of shrank in my seat a little bit. So that's my recollection of this room. So it is great to be back. I went to Andrews Academy, I went to Andrews University, and then did my law degree at the University of Colorado Boulder. And I've had the privilege of working with some wonderful faculty there, and actually wrote the book that that was just discussed with a law professor at the University of Colorado. So we're going to be talking about governing the global commons, international environmental law. Now, before we get into that, let me just explain a little bit about who I am, where I come from. As was said previously, I'm a research professor, and I hold a joint appointment at CU Colorado, which is the kind of flagship university for the state of Colorado. But I work for an institute, the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute, which is actually affiliated with the National Lab. So it's an unusual arrangement. We're affiliated with the U.S. National Renewable Energy Laboratory based in Golden, Colorado. And it's the only federal lab that's specifically dedicated to renewable energy. So, you know, I actually occupy, I think, kind of an enviable interdisciplinary position where we work with policy analysts, economists, modelers, climatologists, atmospheric scientists writ large. So it's a really nice interdisciplinary nexus to work both at the university and within the National Lab system. I'm also the managing director of a research consortium between, as was said before, the federal government and Colorado's three major research laboratories. And the mission that we take at this institution called the Carbon Management Center is to tackle the issue of global climate change from a policy perspective and from a technology perspective. So we do quite a lot of analysis, publications, reports on how to shape policy to help improve the environment and global climate change. But we also work quite a lot on the technology side. So we do things like carbon capture and storage, how to capture carbon from power plants and store it deep in the subsurface, which may or may not be a good idea. We'll see. So what I am, a research professor, attorney. I have expertise in these areas, energy and climate policy, carbon capture and storage, enhanced oil recovery, climate change, natural gas, renewable, smart grid. What I'm not. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a power plant expert. I'm not a climate modeler. So when we get into certain questions, I'll defer you to, you know, if we're going to talk about global climate change and somebody wants to debate the science of climate change with me, I'll quickly shut that down and say, well, I'll be happy to refer you to an expert climatologist. All right. So what we're going to talk about today, governing the global commons, international environmental law. This is just a brief outline of the kinds of things that I hope we can go through today. I first want to just talk about what the concept of international law is. What does it actually mean when we say international law? What kinds of things are we talking about? Secondly, we're going to look at not only what it is, but what are the sources? What are the forms? How is international law made? How does it come into being? How does it become authoritative? Then we'll get into more topically specific stuff, the global commons and how international environmental law, and notice we're now putting the environmental modifier in there, how international environmental law attempts to deal with problems that interact with the global commons, such as climate change. And then we'll get into the specifics of how actually international environmental law has sought to deal with this very nettlesome problem, it's kind of a euphemism, of global climate change. So my hope for this presentation is to just give you a brief window. We have an hour. This is an exceedingly complex subject matter. As I'm sure many of your speakers present to you, complex things, but try to simplify it for the sake of the hour, I hope to show you some of the idiosyncratic quirks of this field, because there are a lot of them in here. I also hope to show you how it's developed and how it's been applied to this extraordinarily difficult problem of climate change. And then I'm going to conclude with some questions that I hope will lead us to kind of an engaging, not so much Q&A session, but more of a discussion. I hope that's the case. All right, so what is law? Seems rather a silly question. What is international law? Is international law actually law? And does this question matter, or why, and why? Or is this just the semantical gymnastics of lawyers? Does it actually make a difference if we call international law, if we call it something else? So let's start with this. There was, you know, for many years, there has been this concept that John Austin, who's a legal positivism philosopher in the early 18th century and mid-19th century, and he formulated a definition of what law is. And I'd like to read you that definition because it forms kind of the seminal argument point for the jurisprudence surrounding international law. What I mean is everybody has argued about this definition ad infinitum onward, okay? So John Austin put forward this idea of what law is. And he said, law is the command of the sovereign backed by a threat of force in the event of noncompliance. Legality is determined by the source of a norm or a law, not the merits of its substance. So it doesn't matter if it's a good law, it doesn't matter if it's a bad law. What matters is, was it issued by the bona fide sovereign? And is it backed by a threat of force? Okay? And so you can see this is how we would understand what we call domestic law, right? We have a quote unquote federal government or a state government. They can be analogous to the sovereign in this state. In this instance, if they issue a law, we have to obey it, or there is a threat of force. You know, whether it's a civil penalty or a criminal penalty, there's a threat of force. So you can see how John Austin encapsulated this very nice definition of domestic law. Okay, so the answer to what is law is answered by resorts to its pedigree, so to speak, not its moral value. In Austin's view, if you have a rule R, it's legally valid, i.e. it's a law, in a society only if it's commanded by the sovereign and is backed up with the threat of force. So that doesn't really work in the international sphere, right? We have autonomous nation states. There is no sovereign, so to speak. Every nation is a sovereign unto themselves. There are their own sovereigns. So if you have a country, let's say country X, and it enters into a treaty with another country, country Y, and then proceeds to repudiate the terms or breaks the terms, what then? There's no threat of force, so to speak. So you can see how Austin's conception of law immediately runs into a problem here. In the international arena, if all of us are representing individual countries, and you choose to eschew or repudiate your international obligations, what can I do to you? In certain forums, there may be some minor enforcement capabilities, but in most, it's a political system that is how we enforce this. So in Austin's conception, international law is nothing more than political rhetoric. It's nothing more than countries doing what they were already going to do anyway. So there's no compliance pool. There's no way to get countries to do something that they didn't want to do through this kind of thing, this nebulous thing of international law. This is Austin's problem with international law. So down here, this is something that I do want to focus on, this last comment. Is international law merely a euphemism for international morality, or even more cynically, is it just politics masquerading in the semblance of law? And I know we do have a kind of formal time for questions after this, but if you do have questions, a burning question that you want to ask me, please just raise your hand and we'll take it on the fly. So I've explained to you this idea that you had a group of people who declared that international law, and this was a very hot debate after World War II, that international law wasn't bona fide law. And you had a group of people that responded, yeah, it may not be law, but there are political issues that help push countries in a different direction than they might otherwise have gone. Now, in 1927, the International Court of Justice put forward what they thought their definition of international law would be. And let me take the time to read it for you. International law governs relations between independent states. The rule of law binding upon states, therefore, emanate from their own free will, an important concept, as expressed in conventions or by usages generally accepted as expressing principles of law and established in order to regulate the relations between those coexisting communities or with a view toward the achievement of common aims. So this is kind of a formalistic definition. It simply says that international law is the free expression of a kind of contractual arrangement that states enter into on their own. Now, that's the formalistic definition. You have the other definition that Austin's promulgated, which is that it's not law at all. I think nowadays, in truth, we understand international law to be kind of a blend of what Austin said, which is that it's kind of this political nebulous area in which nation states interact with one another. But there are institutions, there are adjudicative processes that do force nation states to do certain things. So what I'd like to come to is this notion that international law is not clearly the command of a sovereign backed by the threat of force. That is true. It is not like domestic law. But there is an argument to be made that international law does have an impact on countries and does force them to do things that they would not otherwise have done in the absence of that instrument. It's an argument, one that much ink has been spilled on and is still being spilled on. Okay. So is international law law? And does this question matter? Is it just semantical gymnastics? In short, the reason that we ask this, the reason that we ask this with international law and international environmental law specifically, is because we want to know if the law constrains behavior. We don't want to be just doing this for window dressing, so that nation states can say that they're bound to treaties that are protecting the environment or something else, when in fact they're just doing what they already would have done. We want to know, does it simply codify what they were going to do anyway, or does it actually change the impact of what, change what they were going to do? Now, this last sentence here, how can you measure the impact of a law? This is a really interesting question to me. If you and I, if you're a country and I'm a country, and we enter into a bilateral treaty, and it says that you're going to do something to protect the environment, and you were going to do that anyway, then what impact did the law have? Arguably none, because you were going to do it anyway. But if you entered into that agreement and you fulfill the terms of that agreement, you can see how it's very easy to say, oh, look, they had a treaty, and they fulfilled the terms of that treaty, so the treaty must somehow be causally connected to what these countries were going to do or what these countries ended up doing. It's really difficult to measure the impact of a law if you don't know what a country was going to do anyway, right? So let's talk about where international law comes from, some of the sources, some of the forms of international law. How do we find it? How do we make it? Yes?
I just wonder if you can interject two elements into this understanding of international law. Number one, Islamic terrorists. Two, Korea, North Korea, because they don't have the same concept of community, nor do they have the same concept of morality. If we define
Let me pause you one thing. I know that we're recording this, so and Gary, how much does this mess up your recording if we're having people comment without the microphone? We can always edit. That's the answer. Edit. Please, go ahead.
International law. How do we fit these people in there who So the Sioux tribes, they had a guy called Hokie. He was somebody who was appointed. If nobody could come to a resolution, he knew that it was his job to take care of it. Now, we have Interpol today, I think, to contact that. But he could go out, he could kill, he could do anything.
Let me just pause you, just one, and thank you for the question. It's an excellent question. To summarize, I think the question was, how does international law comport with the concept of a rogue state like North Korea and Islamic terrorists? These are, of course, very easy questions to answer. So I think that, you know, I'm not sure what the specific question is. To kind of tease out your question, I would say, if you posit that you have a system of law and order, that you have a nation of communities that are supposed to abide by moral norms and international principles, and you have people that act outside of those norms and principles, what do you do with them? How does that come in, you know, how do you reconcile that?
How do you justify what you do to them?
I think a good, and I don't have an answer for your question, but I think a good example of what was done is in post-war Germany, right? So we had a huge amount of international law that was developed immediately in the aftermath of World War II, because we had this concept of all these war crimes that needed to be tried. And in that process, there were a number of what we call general principles of international law, customary international law. All of this law was, in fact, developed, you could say, around the trials and around the issues that happened in post-war Europe. So it is, I suppose, my way of saying that when you confront a situation like that, you often make it up as you go. Okay. And then this last one, how is it enforced? This is a very problematic aspect of international law generally, and even more so for international environmental law. In a lot of situations like human rights or with war crimes, you'll find adjudicative bodies, international adjudicative bodies, that have compulsory force. They can draw the parties and actually issue binding decisions regarding war crimes, The Hague, for instance. You don't find that very often in the arena of international environmental law. So if we enter into a treaty to prevent transboundary harm from, let's say, Canada to the United States, and you break the provisions of that treaty, does the treaty itself say that I can haul you into an international court and make your country pay damages? Not usually. That's not usually something that countries will agree to when they enter into a treaty, which means that there is largely an absence of enforcement mechanisms within international environmental law itself. So that leads you back to the Austinian question of how can you even call this law if it's what countries were going to do anyway, largely, and if there's no enforcement mechanism for when they decide not to do it. So what is international law? There's an entity called the International Court of Justice, which has been around prior to World War I and in different incarnations post-World War II. It's the International Court of Justice, and it has a constitution. Article 38 of that constitution is widely understood to embody not only the terms with respect to the International Court of Justice, but it's widely understood to embody what international law is. It spells it out, it delineates it. So let me read this to you. This court, whose function is to decide in accordance with international law such disputes are submitted to it, shall apply. And this is kind of the canonical list of what we consider to be black letter international law, if you will. International conventions, another word for that is treaties, or accords, or protocols. Whether general or particular, establishing rules expressly recognized by the contesting states. International custom is a form of international law. Custom as evidence of a general practice accepted as law. There's some nuances there that we'll get into. The general principles of law recognized by civilized nations, and then, subject to the terms of another article, judicial decisions and the teachings of highly qualified publicists in various nations as a subsidiary or secondary, non-equal means for the determination of rules of law. And do note that this definition is by no means complete. It doesn't include things like UN resolutions and declarations, which we typically call soft law because they're not binding on anybody, but they show what the polity is thinking, what the community of nations is thinking in terms of a particular issue. So those are what we consider kind of the black letter sources of international law. Let's talk about them in order, if you will. Treaties. Treaties are probably what we all commonly understand as international law. I'm sure most of you have heard of the Kyoto Protocol. How many of you have heard of the Kyoto Protocol? Okay. Or conventions dealing with ozone or transboundary pollution. This is what we commonly think of as the most accessible and easily apparent form of international law. An international agreement concluded between states in written form and governed by international law. So you see that last part. Treaties are themselves governed by international law. So when you interpret a treaty, when a judge or a court interprets a treaty, all of those other forms and sources of law, whether it be the general principles or custom or the writings of publicists and judges, those are used to interpret the international agreements. Pact sunt servanda is the basic notion that nations are bound to keep the promises they make. So this is a general principle of international law. In the United States, we have two types of treaties, if you will. We have treaties that are Article 2, Section 2 treaties. These are ones that have been ratified by two-thirds of the Senate, or approved by two-thirds of the Senate, and ratified by the President. So the United States has entered into probably about 20,000 treaties, bilateral and multilateral treaties with other countries on any number of things. The U.S. State Department puts out a massive tome of treaties that are in force that the United Nations, that the U.S. is a signatory and a party to, and it's quite a number. There's another kind of international agreement that the U.S. can actually promulgate, and this is a little more contentious. It's called an executive agreement. The Constitution gives our president the power to enter into executive agreements that are binding under international law without the consent of the Senate. So this is a nicety that is really quite important. If we, as the United States, promulgate an executive agreement and the Senate is not at all involved, there is no difference under international law as to whether or not it was an Article II treaty or an executive agreement. Under international law, it's the same thing. It is a bona fide instrument that binds the parties. You see what I'm saying? Customary international law. This is probably something that's a little bit more esoteric and harder for non-lawyers and non-specialists to wrap their brains around. Honestly, it's just a little peculiar. It largely refers to this unwritten body of law that is inferred from the conduct of states undertaken in the belief that they were bound to do so by law, opinio juris. That's what we refer to. So let me unpackage this for you. When we say customary international law is law, what we mean is if I am a country and I engage in a particular behavior, such as not allowing hazardous material to be dumped into the ocean, and I do this over a repeated period of time, and then somebody comes, an argument is made, another country says, this is customary international law. Let me back up. If I prevent my operators from dumping into the ocean and another country comes and sues me and says, this is customary international law, you prevented your operators from dumping into the ocean and now one of your operators has abrogated that. They've done that. They've dumped materials into the ocean. I can come back and say, you're right. For the last 20 years, we've stopped our operators from doing that, but we didn't actually think we had to do that. We just did it because we thought it was the good thing to do. So that's practice without belief, right? And it's not customary international law. But if I was caught on record in a diplomatic note or some kind of message saying, we in fact are stopping our operators from dumping in the ocean because we believe that we are obligated to do this under international law, then guess what? They have a claim because not only did the practice occur, but belief occurred as well. Now, I hope you see that this is profoundly circular, right? So customary international law is developed only when you engage in law that you already thought was law. That is the kind of curiosity, I think, that a lot of non-specialists have, and they look at this and say, this doesn't really quite make sense. I won't try to really unpackage it for you now. I'm just trying to go through the sources. Customary international law is largely unwritten, but in the legal academy and in judicial settings, we often take what's called unwritten law, this kind of customary international law, and we restate it in written form. These are called authoritative restatements. So this note here, which is simply that a lot of this is codified by the American Legal Academy, by the International Legal Academy into written form that is then used, again, as an argument in judicial proceedings. Additional sources, I listed these here simply because I didn't want to go into too much detail, but we have general principles of law, that pact sunt servanda, that countries are obligated to keep the agreements they enter into. There are many such general principles of law. We have judicial decisions. Now, judicial decisions are interesting in that you can have an American court, you can have a European court enter into a decision between countries. That's what we call typically private international law. When we talk about public international law, the law governing the relationships between countries, judicial decisions are often handled by international bodies like the Court of Human Rights and many other entities. We also have soft law. So if the United Nations comes out with a declaration against infringements on human rights, that's not binding on anybody, right? But the question is, does it have any political force, or is it just window dressing? You know, and scholars spend much intellectual effort trying to puzzle that out. And then increasingly, international environmental law is run by something that we call voluntary agreements. And this gets back to that Austinian problem that we talked about before. So for many years, there was a huge effort to have these gigantic multilateral treaties with many, many countries participating, and they would all be compulsorily bound by the terms of that treaty. As it's gotten harder and harder to engage in these kind of big omnibus lawmaking treaties, countries have kind of stepped back from that and said, well, we'll just engage in voluntary agreements, kind of bilateral agreements. Well, we'll do this, but we're just going to do it on a voluntary basis. So if you are governing the global commons, let's say the global atmosphere, one of the questions that you want to look at is, can we actually achieve significant reductions in carbon dioxide, if that's your goal, through voluntary agreements by countries as opposed to something that forces them into a discomfort zone? I want to talk about, we're moving into a more topically applied space now, the global commons and international environmental law. I do want to briefly talk about one of these cornerstone cases. In every field of law, there's kind of a cornerstone case that dictates the jurisprudence and the legal thinking for many, many decades to come. And in this instance, it's a 1941 case. It's called the Trail Smelter case. And it was a pretty interesting case in which we had emissions from Canada, sulfur dioxide emissions from Canada that were kind of wafting over the border into Washington. And they were causing harm to the farmers in Washington. And so the United States said, we are going to enter into international arbitration in an international court, and we're going to say that you guys owe us some damages for having the sulfur dioxide come over our border. So the Trail Smelter Court wrote, under the principles of international law, no state has the right to use or permit the use of a territory in such a manner as to cause injury by fumes in or to the territory of another, or the properties or persons therein, when the case is of serious consequence and the injury is established by clear and convincing evidence. So at the end of the day, in the Trail Smelter arbitration, Canada had to pay the US restitution, something very small, about $1 million. But the point of that was that there was no Canadian law that controlled. And since the damage was happening in Canada, US law didn't apply. So the court actually applied international law. It resulted in two major principles. A state, in this instance Canada, has a duty to prevent transboundary harm, which is commonly expressed in the Latin maxim, and I won't even do that. And this other thing called the polluter pays principle, which holds that the polluting state should pay compensation for the transboundary harm it has caused. Now, if you really want to put your brain in a twister, try to apply what that would mean for global climate change. All right. So international environmental law. You know, until 1972, the treaties, the judicial decisions that dealt with the environment at a global level were largely ad hoc, kind of, you know, specific idiosyncratic problems that were being addressed by instruments designed exactly for that. But around 1972, as many in this room will know better than I, since I wasn't born until 1974, there was a growing awareness about environmental engagement. This was The Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. There was a lot of interest in the environment. You had the Club of Rome talking about how the world was going to run out of resources. There was a lot of concern about the finite resources of the planet, about the carrying capacity, how much could we sustain in terms of population. And so you started getting these big efforts at the international stage to have not just problem-specific treaties, but treaties that were kind of lawmaking treaties that would provide frameworks to help countries deal with big environmental problems. The first such convention was this 1972 Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment. And there are many such, if we go through this historical continuum in detailed form, there are many iterative steps through this, but I'm just listing a few. Then, in 1990, and I should have listed that date, we had the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, right? So this is the big omnibus convention that governs how we interact with the oceans on our planet and sets the rights for nations with respect to their own oceans. The United States is not a party to this. One of the reasons is UNCLOS, as we call it, the United Nations Law of the Sea, is one of the few treaties that has a compulsory adjudicative system, which means that if Japan and another country have a dispute over fishing rights, the court can drag them into its jurisdiction. By dint of being parties to this treaty, they can be forced into this and then have remedies that they have to comply with. So this is one of the rare instances in which international environmental law has that Austinian concept of backed by the threat of force, because there's compulsory adjudication here. And then we had the 1992 Earth Summit, which was one of the biggest international conventions of its time, and in fact probably to this day, which resulted in a number of major steps that I won't go into. One thing to keep in mind is when I talk about omnibus treaties, I think I've used that term two or three times now, what I mean by that is you can have a big treaty that sets a framework for how states interact on a big issue, like protecting the oceans. And then you'll have a number of smaller treaties or protocols or accords, it doesn't really matter what you call them, that people will work out on a more bilateral relationship, and it fits into this framework, right? So an example of this in climate change is this big omnibus treaty called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The United States is a party to this. But then underneath the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, we have the Kyoto Protocol, which is meant to actualize the ambitions of that omnibus treaty, right? And the United States is not a party to the Kyoto Protocol, right? But it is a party to the omnibus treaty. So that's what I mean by these omnibus treaties. All right. The impact of the cases, the international lawmaking efforts from 1972 onward have really resulted in just a very few principles that are generally accepted around the world as being bona fide parts of international environmental law. And that's sustainable development, the precautionary principle, and the polluter pays principle. These are kind of the cornerstone of modern international environmental law. The cynic in me says, these are the most ambiguous, nebulous terms that you could possibly arrive at. No wonder you agreed that these are part of international environmental law. The real, I suppose, work comes in when you try to define what these mean in a specific instance. Let's talk about sustainable development, though, because it is an important part of international environmental law. The concept of it was kind of formalized by this commission in 1987, the Brundtland Commission report. And they opined that sustainable development is defined as the process that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. The Earth Summit, which was held in 1992, is kind of an embodiment of this principle. But you can see how this definition is very neatly composed. It says we do what we need for ourselves, but we don't compromise the needs of future generations. But when you put that in practice, and you actually have instances in which one country doesn't want something to happen and another country does want something to happen, how do you square that with a definition as solidly ambiguous as this? So what's this all about? Global climate change. Let's start to get into the specifics of global climate change and how this international environmental law and all its mechanisms have been rallied to address the problem of global climate change. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've developed a civilization, obviously, that is largely rested on extraction and burning of fossil fuels for energy. Fossil fuels, if you burn them, they release CO2 into the atmosphere. Interestingly, so does clearing forests. This is one of the biggest contributors to climate change, is deforestation. So it's not just about power plants and cars, it's about our terrestrial carbon sinks. So it's just as big of a problem as if Brazil is clearing its rainforests as if we're building another coal-fired power plant. Rice cultivation, animal rearing releases methane, another very powerful greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. Rising CO2 levels and some other gases lead to rising temperatures. And if this continues, it's not good. I'll just say that. So what do we do about it? Are there solutions, technological? Are there lifestyle solutions? Do we have to live in the dark? What do we do about something that seems as impossible to adequately respond to as energy? Energy is part and parcel of all of our lives. How do you turn the economy around when it's almost entirely dominated by fossil generating sources of energy? So, two terms that I would like you to familiarize yourself with as we go forward. They're mitigation and they're adaptation. Let's just assume arguendo. Let's just assume that global climate change is happening and that mankind is responsible for it and that we have a responsibility to do something about it for future generations. Mitigation would mean that we want to take the problem of global climate change and turn it down so it's not as much of a problem. We want to make it so that the consequences of global climate change, be they sea level rise, increased aridity, desertification, whatever it is, we want to make sure that those problems don't happen in the way that they were going to happen. We want to reduce the intensity of those problems. That's mitigation. That means stopping the amount of CO2 that goes into the atmosphere. That's different than adaptation. Adaptation says, we realize that the CO2 in the atmosphere is going to be there for a very long time. We also realize that we're probably not going to be able to adequately mitigate all of the climate change that's already happening, so we better get ready for it. We have to do something to adapt to the future, not just mitigate the problem that we're trying to address. So these seem innocuous enough, but these are very contentious terms in international legal negotiations. For many, many years, when you had these big climate conferences all around the world, the idea of adaptation was anathema. You couldn't bring it up. When Vice President Gore at one time brought it up, he was ridiculed and reviled. And the reason being was adaptation was seen as a cop-out, right? If you at the international meetings are saying, listen, we can't really deal with climate change, let's worry about adapting, let's get the island of Palau raised 20 feet, let's do something like that. That was seen as being a sellout, being somebody who wouldn't take the idea of mitigation seriously. So adaptation as an international focus was really pushed to the side for many, many years, and the focus is on mitigation. Only in recent years, as I think scientists and public policymakers have come to terms with the fact that we are going to have to live with a certain amount of climate change no matter what, no matter how aggressive our technological or lifestyle solutions are, we're going to have to live with a certain amount of climate change, has adaptation started to come to the fore as an international focal point. Background. So there's kind of a historical continuum with international law and a historical continuum with the international response to this problem of global climate change. We had, in 1979, the first World Climate Conference, which established some important international bodies. We had the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which I've mentioned, in 1992. In 97, we had the Kyoto Protocol, which didn't enter into force for many, many years. A treaty typically has to have a certain number of parties that sign on to it in order for it to enter into force for all of the parties. And so for many years, the Kyoto Protocol didn't have enough signatories. And then finally, in about 2005, Russia and some other folks signed it, not the United States, and it entered into force. It became a binding treaty on everybody that was involved in the Kyoto Protocol. Now, the Kyoto Protocol led to a number of subsequent agreements that I'm going to get into, not really to get into the minutiae of them, but just to show you how this process works, the Bali Action Plan, the Cancun Agreements, the Durban Platform, and Doha. I have to say, it's really nice to go to a climate conference in Cancun. All right, so we had the 1979 World Climate Research Program, the 1991, that's the middle box, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the Global Framework for Climate Services in 2009. The important one for our purposes is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So it's a global legal instrument, international agreement on the control and management of greenhouse gases, adopted in 1992, entered into force in 1994. It has 189 parties. So this is not a small treaty. It has 189 countries that have agreed to be bound by its terms. It contains a number of annexes. For our purposes, there are two that are really important. Annex one, countries with obligations to take measures to mitigate climate change. Annex two, countries with obligations to provide financing to developing countries for their obligations under the United Nations Framework Convention. And it, of course, led to the Kyoto Protocol. So what's the overall goal of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change? It is to protect the climate system for the benefit of the present and future generations of mankind. It sounds familiar, right? Similar to the Brundtland Sustainability Commission's definition of sustainability. What are its further objectives? To achieve stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. So we want to stop the amount of greenhouse gases that we as a society, as a global society, are emitting so that it doesn't lead to dangerous climate change. And you can imagine the kind of scientific debate over what dangerous means, okay? So this, I'm going to call it the UNCCC, UNFCCC, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. That treaty occupies this box right here, over here on the right. The reason I show you this diagram is just to show you how this sits in the international hierarchy. You have the UN General Assembly up here. You have the United Nations Environmental Program, the World Meteorological Organization. Both of these feed into something called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How many have heard of a report issued by a body called the IPCC? Okay. The IPCC is the scientific body charged with understanding the impact of climate change and helping policymakers figure out appropriate technological and scientific solutions to this phenomenon. So it is a body of several thousand scientists all around the world. They provide actual guidance to the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, which is composed of those 180-plus countries. Now, the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, forgive me for all this Byzantine architecture, has what we call a Conference of the Parties. That Conference of the Parties is advised by two other groups, plus the IPCC. There are literally tens of thousands of individuals and entities that work in this milieu, so you can imagine how complicated it is to get anything done with something like this. The Kyoto Protocol. You've mostly heard of the Kyoto Protocol. It was adopted in 97, as we said, entered into force in 2005. It has binding targets for 37 out of 84 countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, very importantly, when the Kyoto Protocol was promulgated in 1997, there was this principle that was enshrined in it. We talked about principles of international environmental law. This is such a principle. It is the idea that there should be common but differentiated responsibility among the nations of the world. This is to say that the industrialized nations like the United States, like the countries in the EU, were largely responsible for the problem of climate change. Our industrialization, if you look at the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere, most of it is from the industrialized world, the vast majority of it. Now, it's true that China actually emits more carbon dioxide than we do now, and India is on pace to do that in the very near future. But if you look at the bank of CO2 that's in the atmosphere, it is by far from the industrialized world. So the idea here was the developed countries, those which have the resources, because they benefited from industrial revolutions that emitted the CO2, those countries should take the lead in dealing with climate change. And they should help the developing countries, which still have economies that need to grow, grow their economies without falling into the same trap. That was this idea of common but differentiated responsibility. The reason I focus on this is because it has been the sticking point in negotiations on climate change since the very beginning. It was a great idea. It seems like a great idea that those who are most responsible for something should take care of it. But what do you do in a problem when, even though you are most responsible for it and somebody else is not most responsible for it, they soon will be doing even more damage than you ever did? What do you do then, right? So the United States signed on to this. The United States was never a party to the Kyoto Protocol, but the United States tacitly said, okay, common but differentiated responsibility. But in the negotiations that are going right now, the United States has said, we can't have common but differentiated responsibility. It just won't work for the climate anymore. We have to have the developing countries agree to binding emission targets just like we're going to agree to. Otherwise, the climate system is never going to be stabilized. The developing countries, of course, will come back and say, you've got to be kidding. Our most important priority is the health and economic growth of our people. Climate change is a serious concern, but we want to lift our people out of poverty. We want to electrify our rural areas. We want to make sure that we have the same level of industrialization that you all have. Of course, if they do it the same way we did it, that's a big problem for the climate. So the Kyoto Protocol, its basic characteristics. It commits Annex I countries, the developed world, to reduce GHG emissions by about 5% by 2012 compared to 1990. It had an actual commitment period that's already expired, which I mean people were supposed to have done this between 2008 and 2012. That didn't happen. Individual goals for each country, so the US goal, for instance, was about 7% below 1990 levels. Now, to help you with where the US sits on the Kyoto Protocol, when Vice President Gore went to Kyoto, he signed the Kyoto Protocol, okay? But that didn't make us a party to it. It made us a signatory to it. When he came back and tried to sell it in the Senate, it didn't fly, and so the Senate rejected it, which means that we are not a party to the Kyoto Protocol, even though we're a signatory. We're not bound by its terms. So the Kyoto Protocol came up with three mechanisms to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions around the globe. The emissions trading system, the clean development mechanism, and joint implementation. I'm just going to dwell really briefly on the clean development mechanism because I think it's quite interesting. And Gary, are you going to give me time?
I'll watch the clock for
you. You watch the clock for me, thank you. All right, so the clean development mechanism is an international legal mechanism whereby developed countries can help developing countries reduce their emissions. So let's say in a developing country, let's say in South Africa, they're going to build a coal-fired power plant, and it's going to emit quite a lot of carbon dioxide. But Britain comes in and says, you know what? We're going to help you retrofit this coal. We're going to help you with this coal-fired power plant. We're going to make it super critical so that you don't have as much CO2 coming out of it. Now, Britain can actually get credit for the reduction in CO2 between that represents the difference between the supercritical plant that Britain is going to help them build and the old regular coal-fired facility that they were going to build on their own. So this one emits much less, this one emits much more. The difference Britain gets to pocket as part of its reductions, right? As part of its commitment against the Kyoto Protocol. Now, I hope you see that this is a way of making the developing countries more technologically advanced, helps industrialized countries meet their obligations, but I hope you see that there are some serious problems with this, which is to say, who is to say that India actually wasn't, or not India, but South Africa wasn't actually thinking of building a supercritical plant in the first place? There's a lot of gamesmanship that goes on with these kinds of programs. So you can posit a counterfactual situation. This is what we were going to do in the absence of this clean development mechanism. And then you have this clean development mechanism. Now this is what we're going to do because it exists. But there's really no way of knowing what the counterfactual actually was. So it's a very difficult measuring exercise to give credit to countries for these kinds of initiatives. And of course, we have an extraordinary international bureaucracy that's intended to analyze this. Kyoto Protocol ratification, a pretty simple map that shows you the countries that have not ratified it, the United States and Australia. And this chart is rather old. A number of countries, including Australia and Canada, have backed out of the Kyoto Protocol. Now, when we came up with this scheme, the Kyoto Protocol, there were Annex I countries and countries that we called economies in transition. And this was largely the Eastern European economies, the former Soviet states. So Estonia, Latvia, Hungary, Czech Republic. Now, it's interesting. In the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, what happened to the power production in the former Soviet states? It precipitously fell because their economies were in shambles, right? So the amount of CO2 they were releasing into the atmosphere fell very, very, very far. Now, when the Kyoto Protocol came along, they had to set baselines for those targets. Are you going to reduce 7% by 1990, below 1990, 5% below 1990? But in 1990, the emission levels of these former Soviet states was so low that the baseline was set really, really artificially low, which means their targets were extraordinarily easy to meet. I hope that makes sense to you. So, pretty simple cartoon for explaining how some of this stuff works. You have a CO2 limit for those industrialized Annex I countries, and you have companies that operate for those countries. They're incorporated in those countries. If you have a limitation on the amount of CO2 you can emit, you can either pay a fine, you can carry out carbon reduction through improvements in processes, you can buy CO2 credits on what's called an emission trading scheme, or you can do what I was just talking about, that clean development mechanism where you help developing countries by reducing their emissions through technological innovation. Okay, I'm going to skip this. So this is to show you how long this took. It took a long time. 1990, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiations begin. We are now all the way to 2012. We are nowhere near able to deal with CO2 from all the countries around the world. You can see how torturous, how long this process is. But what I'd like to do is explain some of the things on the right of this dotted line. The Kyoto Protocol, the Bali Action Plan, Copenhagen Accord. We'll go through these very quickly. Okay, good. The Copenhagen Accord. I was in Copenhagen for the Copenhagen Accord, and we call it the Nopenhagen Accord. Because it didn't happen. There was complete and absolute intransigence on this idea of common but differentiated responsibility. The developing countries didn't want to enter into binding emission reduction targets. The developed countries insisted they had to. So there was this kind of absolute friction between the two. Nonetheless, they did set, President Obama flew in at the last minute. I remember it was this high drama. He flew in at the last minute, entered into closed-door meetings with all of the heads of states that were at Copenhagen, and produced what's called the Copenhagen Accord, which is a voluntary agreement, not a binding agreement. So we talked about that shift in international environmental law toward voluntary agreements as opposed to binding agreements. This is such an agreement. Each country that was participating in it pledged to do certain things to help reduce their contributions to global climate change, to help hold the global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius relative to pre-industrial times. 116 countries signed on, representing 80% of global emissions, including US and China, and this was seen as a breakthrough, India and Brazil. These are the voluntary mitigation actions that were listed by many of the countries. China, 40 to 45% reduction in emission intensity below 2005 by 2020. Now, this is a peculiarity in that a reduction in emission intensity is not a reduction in net CO2. It simply says that for every dollar of GDP that you produce, the amount of CO2 that it took to produce that unit of GDP decreases. That may not seem easily intuitive, but every year our economy gets more efficient. Every year, regardless of intervention, our economy becomes more efficient because we get better at producing goods, which means that the CO2 associated with each unit of GDP drops on its own. This is why President Bush had a climate intensity target. He was willing to do that because it was dropping on its own anyway. So when you have an intensity target, it doesn't say that the amount of CO2 in the aggregate that you're going to release is reduced. It simply says that you're getting more efficient. Okay? The USA in the range of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, and that's in conformity with our own legislation. So we had a number of other agreements, the Cancun agreements, that tried to put flesh on the bones of this process. I won't go into the Cancun agreements too much, except I was there too, and the beaches are very nice. In 2011, the international community met in Durban, South Africa, and they launched what's called the Durban Platform. And this was the idea that the Kyoto Protocol had met its death knell, that they needed another instrument to carry the effort to reduce global warming forward. So it was agreed in 2011 that at some point in the future, another agreement would be come up with. This is often happens at international meetings, where the most substantive outcome is that they agree to meet at another time to decide on a substantive outcome. They then met in Doha. I was in Doha recently. It's a beautiful place, very hot, where they put more flesh on those bones. Now, they did in Doha agree to a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol's first commitment period expired in 2012. That meant that all those countries that were bound by the Kyoto Protocol are no longer bound by it for that commitment period. But they did agree to a second commitment period, even though in the previous conference they agreed to have another instrument sometime in the future. Now, a subset of countries signed on to that, and they represent about 15% of the global emissions of greenhouse gases. So a considerable drop in the participation for the Kyoto Protocol. Clean development mechanism continues, some other gases were added, et cetera. So here are my concluding thoughts. Starting with where we began, is international environmental law, and this is something that I hope you will think about and that we could have discussion about, is it merely politics masquerading as law, meaning that the effect of these instruments on state behavior is nil, or is marginal at best? If these instruments are merely extensions of what states were doing anyway, enforcement is meaningless. You don't even need an enforcement mechanism because they were going to do it anyway. If stabilizing climate change is the goal, how do we get states to engage in behavior that is non-optimal for them, that in fact is non-optimal for their economies, but optimal for the global commons? In the context of climate change, how do you reconcile two seemingly legitimate goals and contradictory goals, which is to say economic growth for the developing world? We have some 2 billion people across the world that have no access to electricity, even more have no access to clean forms of cooking. How do you reconcile the goal of providing them with energy so that they can get out of poverty, so that they can grow their economies and have the kind of lifestyle that we in the United States appreciate, with the need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels? Because I can tell you fossil fuels are by far and above, in most cases, wind is very competitive now, fossil fuels are the cheapest. And what of this tension between adaptation and mitigation? We, the developed world, have the greatest capacity to adapt relative to those with the least capacity to adapt, which is the developing world. So it's not just this tension that I described at the international level between, oh, you're a coward because you want to do adaptation and you don't want to do mitigation. The Western world has the greatest ability to preserve itself in the face of these disasters. So what kind of responsibility do we have given that tension? And is a major multilateral treaty like the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change or the Kyoto Protocol with 192 signatories even the way to do this? Is that the kind of international forum? Is international environmental law even equipped to deal with a problem of this scale? So there are only, if you took all of the emissions all across the world, we could take the United States, the EU, China, Brazil, South Africa, we could take a handful of countries, and they would represent 90% of the emissions. So should there be a different process, one that takes itself out of this omnibus treaty-making thing? You know, a lot of people have considered the G7 or the G8 as a as an appropriate forum for this. So that's another thing to think about. And with that, Gary, I will conclude.
Okay. All right, questions. I'd like to ask, is there a short answer to why Vice President Gore didn't get the original Kyoto Protocol through the Senate?
The short answer is that the Senate at the time viewed the Kyoto Protocol as a serious blow to the U.S. economy, because we would have had to do what was contemplated, which was reduce our reliance on fossil fuels in a way that was unprecedented. So the Senate really, really pushed back on that. Now, there, in subsequent years, in 2009, you'll recall that the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, and President Obama was president. So you had unanimity all across the board for serious climate legislation. And you had climate legislation passed in the House, and it never made it through the Senate. What else made it through the Senate that year? Healthcare, right? So conventional wisdom says there wasn't enough political oxygen for both.
Other questions?
If Turkey built dams on the Tigris and Euphrates River, for example, so as to substantially reduce the amount of water that flowed south, it would be a cause for war if those southern countries were in a position to wage war, which they aren't right now. Could these international treaties be used as justification for war by countries that were palpably affected by environmental behavior of other countries?
You know, I would argue that they can't be, but they certainly not justification, but they certainly can be used as supporting justification. So you're not going to necessarily, under the UN, UN's many declarations and the rules of war, be able to say that you're going to go to war because you broke a treaty. But certainly, having a broken treaty in front of you is wonderfully supportive in that respect.
When you go to one of your conventions, how many people are you representing worldwide? Those people who are in your field.
So a when you say convention, you're talking about the conventions that I went through.
Like Cancun.
Cancun.
Yeah. How many act? What is the body that you're representing?
So when I go, when I in person go.
No, the whole thing.
Okay. So the way these conventions work, some are big and some are small, but you'll probably have, let's say for Copenhagen, you had the environmental ministers, the energy ministers of all the major industrialized and developing countries show up. So they're all there. They're the principals. They were, the Department of Energy secretary, for instance, for us. They are the principals, and they are given negotiated instructions by their executives. And it's this wonderful situation in which you have entire villages in the area that are reserved for the United States, for China, and there's all this security around them. You have these rooms in which people are having minor negotiating sessions, major negotiating sessions.
That's all good. You haven't understood my question.
Please explain.
If I were a novelist going to some convention and I would be representing a body of novelists, maybe there's 100,000 of us in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to a convention, how many people in the world are you working for, representing, you know, how big is your body of people? Mm-hmm.
So my body of people is not that big because I don't go as a representative. I go as an academic. So maybe there's the discrepancy in the question. You make a really interesting point, though, I think, and I hope this answers your question, which is there is an increasing avenue for non-governmental organizations to participate in treaties like this. So there are people that do come and they represent journalists or they represent the environmental community. They may have 10,000 or 100,000 constituents that they're representing. They are not allowed into the formal negotiating sessions. But the individual countries and blocks of countries, because these are political entities, will often meet with them and take advice from them.
So there is a large body of individuals being employed by environmental law.
There are a large body of people that attend these things that represent their own discrete interests.
Quite an industry, huh?
Yes.
Dr. Ben Carson addressed the issue that the fourth branch of government is really the special interest group. Would you like to comment on that? I think that might be related to your question.
It is the fourth and first and second and third body of government. Absolutely. Special interest at the international level play just as much of a profound role as they do at our federal level. So if you go to conferences like this, you certainly will see major representation from ExxonMobil, from Chevron, from BP, from major polluting sources. They do, they represent themselves substantially at these conferences.
Do you see yourself representing the special interest groups, the country of the United States, the world community, environmentalists in general, or who do you represent and who are you advocating for?
So again, my position when I go to conferences like this, and I'm sorry if it seems like a duck, is as an academic. So I come as an observer. My position is not to represent anybody or to advocate any particular position, but it's to analyze it and understand it and then come back and make up my own critique of it.
If I understand, the argument a little while ago was between economic development and the environment. Do I have it correct that more and more of the economic interest have realized that their self-interest is also wrapped up in the economic, in the environmental issues, and they're beginning to sign on to environmental concerns? This is where I think the phrase corporations are, quote, going green. Do I have that?
Absolutely.
Correct?
So there is definitely an increased consciousness among corporate America, and this is not just anecdotal. You can look at the shareholder filings. You can look at the 10-Ks that are filed every year where their statute, where under federal law, they're required to issue concerns that affect their shareholders. And you can look at many of the S&P 500 and see that they are talking about how climate change, in terms of its physical impacts, not regulatory issues, but in terms of its physical impacts, will affect their bottom line. And you see lots of voluntary efforts by corporate America to address these things. Green and greenwashing, there's a fine line between those. So it's important to make sure that we're not just doing it for advertising or for PR, but we're doing it as a meaningful effort to engage the issue.
Maybe I'm a pessimist, but it seems like you've painted a pretty dismal picture about the ability of our human systems in terms of politics and law and so on to deal meaningfully with the whole issue of climate change and greenhouse emissions and so on. I know this is an unfair question, but from your perspective, what would you see pragmatically as our best hope for something that might actually be achieved? You know, how much can we really mitigate? You know, where might we be able to realistically get in the next 20 or 50 years? Or are we just on an inevitable spiral down the tube?
You know, it's an excellent question. And if I've come across as dour and pessimistic about the international machinery's ability to deal with problems like this, I hope it's simply because I've tried to be accurate. And instead of being like Eeyore up here. In response to your question, The United States, to our own amazement, actually has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions more than any country in the world in the last 5 years. And does anybody know the reason why? That's one reason. There's another big reason. It's shale gas. Shale gas. So the United States is actually undergoing a revolution in shale gas. Shale gas, which is unconventional, tight source rock gas, it's not conventional gas, provided about 1% of our natural gas in the year 2000. It provides about 23% of our natural gas now. Gas has about a third the CO2, the climate forcing impact, as coal. So despite our best efforts to the contrary, we have nonetheless managed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States rather precipitously. So to answer your question, some of the things that could be done are shale gas development in China. For instance, China's building coal-fired generation at an extraordinarily rapid rate. They have more unconventional gas resources than the United States. So seeing technologies, the curious thing about shale gas is it's by far better for the climate than coal is, but you still have to get off of it at some point because natural gas does have a carbon footprint, and you're probably going to have to get off of it before those plants are fully depreciated. So those costs are going to be borne by somebody.
I'm sure you've seen the shale gas development in the Joshua Field of southwestern Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Wyoming, and I see the economic development there basically switching from older fossil fuels to gas. This is not done with any pure intentions by the oil companies or by the gas companies. This is just
that's astonishing.
Simply that we've got a lot of gas in Wyoming, you know, that is available. Cramer the other day came on TV advocating for the Keystone Pipeline mm-hmm. development. He apparently doesn't have any idea what shale-produced oil will mean to the environment in terms of CO2 emissions. I'm a little more pessimistic than you are. I think that the green smoke screen that we're talking about is precisely that. It's a smoke screen. Shell withdrew its oil drilling facilities from Alaska, not because of any pure motive, but because the weather was just too bad for their equipment. They just could not sustain a public relations deal because the weather was blowing their stuff around out there. And so, you know, Austin may be right. The sovereign is necessary, but the sovereign is basically what we might call natural law or reality, whatever it is, and that's going to get us in the end. That's going to enforce it, whether we are intentionally trying to do it or not.
Nature is the ultimate sovereign. I'll concede the point.
You know, it's one thing to talk about the economies of energy and how we get it, but one thing that hasn't been mentioned today is the ethics of how we do things. Whether it's shale gas or oil pumped out of the ground or whatever it is, they all have ethical impacts on us. And I suggest that maybe those ethical impacts will do more to achieve lowering greenhouse gases, if indeed we are ethical beings.
Can you help us understand what you mean by ethical impacts?
That which negatively affects my neighbors or myself, or that which I would think is raping the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Many think that, well, the Lord's coming soon, it won't matter. I think he's given us charge to take care of it and not rape its resources.
Right. So even with something as good for the climate as shale gas, there are environmental externalities, arguably, indeed, good for climate change. There are serious environmental externalities. In order for us to extract this resource, we have to drill at a phenomenal rate. We have to do it near communities. It has the potential to impact water quality, water quantity. So there are lots of ethical issues to be teased through in all of these things. That's very clear.
I wonder if there's an analogy with civil rights law and environmental law. We enacted civil rights legislation such that you cannot discriminate against a person on the basis of their race. But I think, if I understand correctly, at a deeper level, we also understood that at some point, we need to try to change not only the legal aspect, but the heart of the person, so that we didn't see a person from another race as not worthy of this job. And so the law became, if I understand correctly, a kind of stern taskmaster to start us down the road of changing our heart. Is there analogy with environmental law, that we have to start with law and say we can't rape the earth legally, well, and hope that we move toward the notion that God entrusted the care of this earth to us, and we do this not because we're legally bound, but because we want to. We love the earth. We care about the earth.
I think it's a very good analogy to make, but if you recall, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, there was a gigantic grassroots movement to provide support for that. It was tremendous when Johnson signed that, the amount of grassroots support that was there. So to me, it doesn't seem, in many parts of the country, particularly the South, that act got in front of the kind of place where we were, and it led us to where we are now. That is true. But there was such a tremendous amount of support for it in other quarters that it seems a little bit different to me. But not in this respect, and maybe this is a sad statement. The younger people that I talk to get this environmental stewardship concept, get the idea that we need to transition away from fossil fuels, even to our own economic detriment to a certain point. They get that in a way that many other folks don't. So this is my rather cynical way of saying generational shift may be what we need.
There has been a push for individuals to be more ecologically responsible. Don't use colored toilet paper. Don't use plastic shopping bags. Don't buy bottled water and so forth. Have these?
Could you hurry up, because my Hummer is running in the parking lot. I haven't turned it off.
Okay. Well. All right. The question is, have any of these had any impact, or does it just make people feel good?
You know, it's a very good question, honestly, because if you look at the amount of energy that you save by changing your incandescent bulbs in your house to CFLs, if you take all of these little actions yourself, and I don't mean to be pejorative, but these little actions yourself, how much does that add up in the grand scheme of things relative to what we actually need to achieve? And the truth is, it is microscopic in its contribution to where we need to go. But you cannot underestimate the change in mindset that accompanies that, and the change in philosophy, and the change in community. So it's true that if you isolate an individual's action and stack it up relative to what actually needs to be done, it is infinitesimally small and is no way going to contribute to actually meaningfully changing the situation. But a whole group of people thinking like that certainly can.
Well, let's thank Kevin for his presentation today. Kevin is a hometown boy that made good, and we appreciate, or as we say in the English department, a hometown boy who made goodest. This is the last meeting of our season, so we thank you for coming and for supporting us. If you would like, we'd appreciate a small contribution. Vast majority of that money that you contribute pays for people like Kevin's airfare to fly here from Colorado.
One of the best presentations
yes. Yes. Yeah. So, we do spend a tiny bit of money on electronic equipment here to make the meetings a little more audible for us, but most of their money goes to plane tickets. So we appreciate any help you could give us. And we'll start thinking about and planning next season. Thank you very much.